We're going to start this week, Nois Kuf Tes, and I want to give a little preface to what we're about to see here. Because really what the Jewish sage is going to be doing now, we can kind of call this a new discussion, even though it, like the whole style of the Kuzari, it came out of, as a result of all the different tangents we've been seeing up till now, but we can kind of call it a new discussion. He's going to be presenting now Olam Haba, and show how really that was meant to be experienced in this world. How the destiny of the Jewish people is not really divided between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. Olam Hazeh is one stage, Olam Haba is a different stage. Really, the destiny of the Jewish people is meant to be played out in Olam Hazeh, just as in Olam Haba, in the same way, albeit in a bit of a lower level, but actually that Olam Hazeh is mamish beginning the process of Olam Haba, not that there are two separate detached experiences. Olam Hazeh is a world of darkness where you just suffer for Hashem's sake, Olam Haba you get the reward. No, in Olam Hazeh you start actually climbing the ladder to Olam Haba, and there is not a clear line between the two. You can already enter Olam Haba realm in this world. Now, in order to understand that, in order for it not to be abstract for us, I want to give a little bit of a preface. Because what we're seeing here is really going to bring home for us what Jewish existence is supposed to be, which we, Lemaisa, are very far from. But if we want to put this another way, we know that a Jew is supposed to live with the constant consciousness of the fact that we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. Right, one of the first sifim in Shulchan Aruch, not in Hilchas Tisha B'Av. Are you disturbed by the noise right behind you?
Yeah.
You okay?
Yeah.
So we can also move over here if you'll prefer. It'll be easier.
Right here,
right? Yeah, okay. Alright? So, this way we'll be more contained. One of the first sifim in Shulchan Aruch is that a Jew is supposed to live with the consciousness to always be disturbed over the fact that there's no, that we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, that we're in Golus. That's not an Hilchas Tisha B'Av. That's one of the first sifim Shulchan Aruch, because it's really supposed to be a fundamental component of our consciousness all year round. But it's hard to really feel terribly heartbroken over it, because, you know, we read books, we try to get descriptions of what it was like then, but life right now is not all that bad. Right? Sometimes when we're exposed to tzaras, we say, oh, then we won't have those tzaras. But there isn't something that we long for, that we just feel like we can't be going through life without that. What's life worth without that? So actually, what the Kuzari is going to do here is really going to give us a little bit of a taste of what we are actually missing, and will help us develop that consciousness. But in order to appreciate it, I want to give a little bit of a preface. I want to preface it with a mashal, because this really is the essence of the whole concept of mourning to the Beis HaMikdash. I want to give a mashal, which maybe some of you have heard, I'm not sure, but it's fundamental. You have two children, a 3-year-old brother and a 13-year-old brother. Both members of a wealthy family, wealthy aristocratic British family. Okay? They live in a mansion, in a palace in England, in a very upscale area, a life of luxury, very warm relationship with their parents. They live, mamish, the most ideal situation a person can live in. Okay? Now, one time the family decides to go for vacation. They're going to go for a tour of the jungles of Africa. Go to explore the jungles of Africa. Okay? They hire guides, and the whole family goes. They spend a month touring the jungles of Africa. Then somehow or the other, again, this is a mashal, not a true story, it doesn't have to make too much sense, but somehow or the other, these two brothers, the 13-year-old and the 3-year-old, get lost. Get lost in the depths of the jungles of Africa. And won't spend too much time on dramatics, but to keep a long story short, they don't find the family. The family doesn't find them. The family goes back to England. We want to make the story a little more palatable. They're hiring search teams and stuff. Fine. But right now we're going to focus on these two kids. These two kids come from an aristocratic family, lived in luxury for all these years, and are now lost in the jungles of Africa. Okay? So, the first couple of days, they're still hoping they'll find the family. But they don't. And they have to look out for themselves, and they start learning to adjust to life in the jungle. Now, the 13-year-old is a capable kid, and he's able to fend for himself, and he's taking care of his little brother, and they adjust. That's obviously a process, but they learn to adjust to life in the jungle. They start learning to discern between things you can eat and things you can't eat. They start learning to detect subtle signs of danger. They start learning how to find shelter, how to set themselves up. They're moving around from place to place, hoping to find some sign of civilization. And they're basically learning to live. They're learning to utilize the resources of the jungle. Okay? And this turns into a mode of life. A year goes by, 2 years go by, these kids are living in the jungle. They become jungle kids. Now, the 3-year-old kid is now 9 years old. And the 13-year-old is now 19 years old. And the reality of their life is life in the jungle. Okay? Now, the 9-year-old doesn't remember any other life. Doesn't remember any other life. As far as he's concerned, life is life in the jungle. What is luxury? Luxury is finding a passion fruit. That's luxury. Normal life is more boring things like breadfruit. Harder times are leaves, when you don't find even that. But the good times are when you find fruits like passion fruit or things like that. And you know, when you come to a secure place and you can bed up, you have a lot of leaves to make yourself a comfortable bed. Those are the good times. Those are the good times. Okay? And the more difficult times are when there are more waves of hyenas, and when the pickings are limited as far as fruit goes, and you have to make do on leaves. But these are all parts of life. None of these things are intolerable. You can live with all of them. Okay, Lamaisa, he's living with his 19-year-old brother. Feels secure, comfortable. His 19-year-old brother is very good at taking care of him. Good. Now, this 19-year-old brother sometimes sits down and reminisces about the old home. And he's describing it to his younger brother, and the younger brother really sounds good. A home in which you control the weather, right? You can decide when you want it hot, when you want it cold. A home in which there's always a warm, comfortable bed. You don't have to go through the trouble of setting up leaves. Right? A home in which there's food that's much better than passion fruit. He can't really imagine that, but he knows that passion fruit is really good. And he's told that at home, this theoretical, abstract place called home, it's even better. Right? You sleep in the same bed every day, and the brother is starting to describe a mommy's dinner. Okay, all this sounds great. But then there's a weird part of it. There's a little bit of a bizarre part. And this the 9-year-old kid can't get. And the night when his 19-year-old brother is describing these things, when he's describing that supper, he starts getting emotional. He starts getting emotional. Gets tears in his eyes. He gets tears in his eyes when he talks about mommy making the beds for them every day. Okay, that also doesn't make much sense because the family we're describing is the maids who make the beds. But, as I said, it doesn't have to make too much sense. Huh? Yeah. Now, the little kid is having a hard time relating to this. He can understand that food is great. He understands that, yes, it's good to have a safe room. Place. This is mamish utopian existence. There are no hyenas in the whole area. And a steady bed and a really comfortable bed, much more comfortable than any of the leaves. All this sounds very nice. and it would be great if we would be there. But reality as it is now is bearable. Right? He's been living this way his whole life. And besides that, he doesn't understand why his brother would be getting emotional about things like a warm room. No, so he's not getting emotional about that. He's getting emotional about mom and dad. What are mom and dad? From what he's hearing described, mommy's the one who prepares all that good food. And she's the one who makes that bed. And dad's the one who takes us to these fun things. But it's all technicalities. He still doesn't get why that should be a cause for emotion. He knows his brother. His brother's a rugged type. Never gets emotional about food, right? And he's dealt with tough things. You know, there's a guy who knows how to ward off hyenas with a stick that he tears off a palm tree. So why is he getting emotional? And what's weirdest of all is he's getting emotional about the least attractive thing that's being described. The food is attractive. The bed is attractive. The mother who prepares the food. That's what he's getting emotional about. So we have to realize that this kid is missing a whole dimension of reality. We all realize that. Anyone who's experienced a mother's warmth realizes that this kid is hearing symptoms, that he's hearing descriptions of certain external manifestations of what it means to be in a home. But the essence, the primary essence of living in a home is completely beyond him. It's completely beyond him. He can't connect to that. He can't experience that. And he can't understand it because he never has experienced it. And therefore, he's completely in the dark. It's just weird to him. And it just sounds like a bunch of technicalities. You have to realize that this really is the essence of what we're talking about when we're talking about longing for the days of old. We hear this description, we hear that description, right? Karbanis. 10 nisim happened in the Beis HaMikdash. Wow, and I feel I can't live without those 10 nisim, right? The pillar of smoke that went up from the Ketores, I hear, right? I'm told that the pillar of smoke that went up from the Ketores and went straight up and the wind couldn't move it. Ah, all my life is worthless if I don't have the experience of seeing that. No, but that's like hearing the descriptions of the home. Another technicality. But what we can't connect to is to realize that we are mamish as in the dark as a kid who doesn't have in his frame of reference the warmth of a relationship parents, and he's trying to understand it. We have to realize that all these different things that we hear described are manifestations of what it means to live with the Shechina. We have to realize that as intense of an experience as this kid can't relate to, the experience of living with the Shechina, which is really the basis of it all, forget Jewish independence and sovereignty and everything, those are all manifestations. That's not the root, it's not the essence of it all. Right? The essence of it is living with the Shechina. That's why we say second Beis HaMikdash wasn't as great as the first Beis HaMikdash, because we didn't have the Ashras HaShechina. It's like being back home but the parents aren't there. As far as the younger kid is concerned, that's the ultimate. As far as the older kid is concerned, it's missing the point. Right? Younger kid said, who needs the parents? All the food's there, the bed is there, who needs anything more than that? That's it. It's the greatest experience one can imagine. So we have to realize that this is what we're missing. We have to realize that we're missing a whole dimension of quality of life, a whole level of warmth that we are completely detached from. What we were meant to have. That's what Olam Hazeh was meant to be. Forget Olam Haba. That's what Olam Hazeh was meant to be. The bliss of living close to the Shechina and feeling the warmth of the Shechina, feeling the love of the Shechina in a tangible way, not in a theoretical way. Like today, we hear Shiurim about it and we work so hard to try to connect a little bit. Then it was all natural. We're living with the parents. We're living with our father. Now, that's really the essence of what we talk about when we talk about mourning for the Beis HaMikdash. Of course, there won't be tzaris, and we'll have this, and we'll have that, and we'll have this, and we'll have that. Those are all the manifestations of living at home with the parents. So now that we have this perspective, let's approach what the Khazari says. What is the destiny of the Jewish people? What is it that we long for? Because before, as we saw the other week, the king of Khuzar poked fun at him. You keep talking about that the ultimate bliss and what we aspire for, and Olam Haba is connecting with the Shechina. He says that sounds a lot less attractive than what the Muslims describe and what the Christians describe. They talk about of all the women you can want, all the food you can want, right? How does connecting with the Shekhinah compare with all that? But really, this is his point. No, on the contrary. That is the destiny of the Jewish people, and that exceeds, it supersedes, it's way beyond any of these other material experiences you can be describing. Because every material experience you can describe is really just one of those technicalities about being at home that we discussed before. But the main thing is that whole all-encompassing feeling of being at home with your parents. So now he says, let's see how the Kuzari puts this down. Omar HaChaber, here's how he describes this. Avol Yehudenu, what Hashem promises us, the ultimate promise, the ultimate destiny of the Jewish people, which was meant to be lived out in this world as well, he dovkeinu be'inyan ha'eloki, is our bond with the divine. B'nevuah. Now this manifests in many ways. Number one is nevuah. When you're actually living with the Shekhinah, every person has the opportunity of actually connecting through nevuah. And as we've seen before, nevuah was more than just a conversation. It was actually experiencing Olam Haba. The bliss of making that live connection with the Shekhinah was something that the physical mind cannot comprehend. That was Olam Haba. That was something that people can reach in this world. That's how the Jewish people are meant to live. Umashu Kariva. And other such things along the line of Nebuah. And again, when we're living at home with our Father, when the Jewish people as a whole are connected to the Divine in a live way, not just in a theoretical way or on the spiritual realm today that we can't really feel, but in a real, tangible, sensory way, when we're connected to the Divine, when the connection is live, Bigdula u'bechavay u'bemaitzim, that manifests on the Jewish people living in a higher status, in a higher state than any of the nation around, with miracles going on a regular basis. Again, is the miracle, is the point of the miracle the miracle? Miracles are convenient. They can get rid of enemies and stuff. But that's not the main point. The main point is, sure, I don't have to worry about enemies, because that is here. The bad guys start up, that goes out and beats them up. Right? So again, it's that feeling of security. We're with Father, and we don't have to worry about the Goyim. The Goyim start up, Hashem goes out and beats them up. And these are the miracles that we're talking about. It's that experience, that security, that warmth, that all the rest of the world saw and acknowledged, as we described the other week. They saw that the Jews lived in a completely different plane of reality. Everything just worked differently in Eretz Yisrael. Hashem was running the show in a hands-on, personal way. He was right down there with them, involved, a part of things on a daily basis, both on the national scale and on each person's individual, personal level. And here is how he answers the classic question of why does the Torah not discuss Olam Haba? Why are all the promises in the Torah material? And he gives a most profound answer. Therefore, the Torah does not say, "Kim tasa mitzvah zois." If you fulfill these commandments, "Aviachem achrei amoves elginos vanois," I will bring you after death to all kinds of wonderful gardens and pleasures. No, Hashem is better than that. Today, since we aren't connected to the real thing, today, since we are living a very, very, very watered down level of Judaism, detached from the real experience, for us it's about the afterlife. But it's not how it was meant to be, and it's not the Judaism that Hashem was really offering and bestowing to the Jewish people. Rather, what Hashem says is, of course there's Olam Haba, but we don't have to talk about that, because you could already start getting there in this world. Atem tiuli la'am, I will take you close to me as my nation, v'ani eyelochem le'lehim, and I will be close to you as a God in a real, tangible, everyday, hands-on way. V'ani geschem, I will personally be involved in running your life. Running your life. That was how it worked in those days. Today, right, tefillah, We're told, and we see how tefillah can work. But is it automatic? Is it like you daven and there's a response? Today we're in a situation of so some tefillah that's described here. Yirmiyahu HaMelech describes an Eicha. Once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, tefillah was blocked off. Relatively, tefillah is still powerful till today, and we hear very great things about tefillah. We experience very great things with tefillah, but it's not what it was at all. At that time, Hashem was right there, attentive, and responded immediately. Right? Today?
For example.
What's that?
For example,
that's one manifestation of it. How when they dive into the forgiveness, they would see the red string turn white. But people saw it in their daily lives. Anything they daven for. Tefillos were much easier saw the effects of your tefillos. People davened and things happened. Because even when they were davening, the mamish felt the live connection, they felt the live interaction, they felt Hashem on the other side. Because it was all so much more tangible and sensory. He was there. Right? And again, the whole connection will be very live. I might bring people up to Shamayim for some meeting. This is something that went on in those days. You see it described in the Navi, right? As we see descriptions of certain Navim, sometimes Hashem had a rendezvous with the Navi in this world. Other times, I don't know. I don't know what it depended on. Other times, a rendezvous was in the upper world. Hashem brought somebody up, so it was like, you know. He knocked on somebody's door and his wife said he's out of town for the last couple of days. He's meeting with Hashem. But these were things that were going on, right? Yeshua HaKohen HaGadol. We see certain descriptions of it in Nach, how a Navi is lifted up all of a sudden. Right? Yechezkel HaNavi describes being lifted by his hair, right? And Yeshua HaKohen HaGadol is described as, you know, going up to Shemayim, having these discussions with the Malachim and all kinds of things. That was how it worked. This could happen to people on a regular basis. Yes, but even that is a lower level of what we're describing here. We have to realize that the existence in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash was completely unlike anything we can relate to. The existence in the time of the Tanoim in the second Beis HaMikdash, although then too they were able to do a lot of supernatural things, it was basically the existence that we know today. The existence at the time of the first Beis HaMikdash was not. Because Ari is going to tell us later. Later he gets back into this subject. He says, it's like the difference between our experience of Judaism and the experience of Judaism those days, quality-wise, is like the difference between a dead skeleton and a live person. So it was a whole different experience. Meaning we're experiencing Judaism today in a comatose state, or worse. Right? To what Judaism really was when they were up. So now, okay? There was a more glorious time, period of the Midbar. That was the closest period ever, but the time of the first Beis HaMikdash was the time, not necessarily the first Beis HaMikdash, but the whole period, the first period in Eretz Yisrael before Bagolus Bavel, with ups and downs, and at the end, it was basically on the way down, was this. Now, V'karim lahem ha-malachim ben Adam. And like we said before, it was to the extent that, right, we often see in the Navi, at Yechezkel, especially in other Navim, are referred to as ben Adam. You keep hearing him called ben Adam. Man, right? Why does he keep on being referred to as ben Adam? Because so many times when he was getting his nevuah, he was lifted up and plunked among the malachim, that the way he was identified was, oh, there's that person over there. Right? The person, he stood out as a person. He was in a place where there basically weren't people. So he stood out as the person. And that's why Yechezkel keeps being called ben Adam. But this was reality in those times. As we said before, we know of the 48 Nevi'im who were the large-scale national Nevi'im. Whose prophecies were recorded because it needed to be available for all generations. But actually, there were more than a million Nevi'im. People were becoming Nevi'im on a personal level. Not everybody, but a lot of people. It was personal things between him and Hashem that wasn't anybody else's business, so it wasn't recorded. But Chazal tells us that there were 1.2 million Nevi'im in Klal Yisrael. This is something that you worked towards it, you got it. Now, And again, there's that open line between Shamayim and Eretz, which is really what the Beis HaMikdash was. The Beis HaMikdash was the meeting place in Shamayim and Eretz, which was more than just an open line. It was kind of like a freeway. There was traffic going in both directions all the time. There were people going up for visits, and there were Malachim coming down. And Malachim were a common sight in Eretz Yisrael, right? Sometimes not everybody saw them. Malachim b'neichem Eretz. Again, my people, you know, the people from my office will often be around in Eretz Yisrael, taking care of things and carrying out different tasks. The Tiroi Sam Yechid and Verabim. Sometimes only individuals will see them. Sometimes everybody around will see them too. Shaimrim Eschem v'nilchamim lochem. You'll often also see them protecting you and fighting for you. Again, that's the way it worked in Eretz Yisrael. Very tough enemy came. There's a puny Jewish army. Couldn't face off against them. Hashem said, Rabbi Yisai, just stay inside. Let me deal with it. And sends down a company of Malachim, and they just take care of the problem. Right? We know about Sancheirin. Remember Sancheirin? Where Kiskiyot didn't know what to do. They were under siege. Hashem said, don't worry about it. Tomorrow morning everything will be fine. Sent down a Malach, just basically wiped out his whole camp of hundreds of thousands, and that was that. This was one manifestation of the way things worked then. There were other such cases too. And like he says before, sometimes people saw them, sometimes people didn't. Sometimes people sensed their presence, sometimes not. For example, in the case of Elisha. I forgot exactly what the circumstances were, but basically what was going on was that him and a disciple of his were going to make a walk through to enemy territory, and Elisha was very nonchalant about it. He was like, no, we have to walk through this area. And the disciple was very scared. So Elisha said, oh, like it kind of dawned on Elisha, oh, he doesn't see. Hashem, make him see. And then all of a sudden, he said, like his eyes opened, and suddenly he saw that they were surrounded by camps of Malachim that way outnumbered the enemy. Oh, then he can walk through securely. This was the experience of living in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. Betasmidu ba'aretz asher yizeres al amalo azos. And if you live right, you will be able to remain in the land which can entertain all these things. Meaning, not all the world is conducive. Not all the world is compatible with this. All this works only with only in Eretz Yisrael. Vehiat Masa Kodesh. That is Eretz Yisrael. And now, he adds, V'yesava v'toivasa. Now, the satiation, meaning the plenty and the good in Eretz Yisrael, the material blessing, and also the problems in Eretz Yisrael, this is part of the manifestation of the divine presence. In Eretz Yisrael, your state will always state not as in state as in your state of affairs. Your state will always reflect your spiritual standing. It will depend on your performance. And this is something to note, because it's like that till today too. The Jewish people's state as a whole, not on the individual level, the Ramban makes this very important distinction. On the individual level, there are all kinds of cheshbonos. You can have a tzaddik suffering, you can have a rasha prospering. But on the national level, the Jewish people's state of affairs will always reflect their spiritual state of affairs. That explains a lot of things today. But whatever it is, he says you'll always see that. He says the rest of the world will run by nature. Eretz Yisrael will not. Eretz Yisrael will always be uncanny. You might be suffering while everybody else is prospering. You might be prospering while everybody else is suffering. Because it's you, it's not an issue of natural cause and effect. Depending on your spiritual performance, I'll perform. If I give you a spanking, you'll suffer. But again, it's Hashem giving a spanking. That was when the Jewish people suffered. And then, today, we have to be told that, oh, you have to know that if there are tzaris, it's because things are not up to par, because we need to improve. Then it was all obvious. It was just so clear, right, that there was spiritual cause and effect. It was so obvious and so plain to see that people couldn't miss it. Now, while the rest of the world runs by nature, because you'll see that when my Shechina is among you, when I'm busy, when my office is down on this earth, the Beis HaMikdash, when my presence is down there, that you'll see that the land will be completely blessed and that the rains will all be exactly on time. We'll never miss. Now here also we have to understand that the blessing of the land was more than just that they had all the food they needed. But it's like we stressed a few times. When they saw the land producing supernatural fruit, this was thrilling, not because now they have supernatural fruit, but because once again they saw Hashem busy with them. They saw Hashem dealing with them. It's like we said, when a person put spiritual efforts, when a person worked to improve his midas, and then saw his vineyard, the next day his fruits, his grapes were the size of basketballs, he had experienced Hashem stroking his cheek. It's like we said before, Nevuah was the ultimate. But even if there were people who didn't quite reach Nevuah, there were all kinds of other ways to mamish experience in a live way Hashem busy with you, and Hashem giving and taking, and Hashem interacting. You'll overcome your enemies with very small armies. This is the way things ran. I think I quoted recently, I think in the Tanakh Shir, that supposedly one of the instructors at West Point military training camp said that they don't study the Jewish wars, even though they study all kinds of other wars in those periods of history, because it's all just uncanny. There isn't really any pattern or any explanation that they can give to it. That's the way it worked. Sometimes they had a mighty army that lost the war to a weak nation. Sometimes they had a puny handful of people who couldn't fight, who had a miraculous victory against the mighty army, because it was really just an issue of Hashem playing games. Now, Masha Takiru Boy, and it will be as clear as day. Your whole life's experience will be that your state of affairs does not run by natural causes, but rather by decision. You'll always wake up in the morning and you'll see there was a decision to do this, a decision to do that. You'll see that the whole atmosphere in Eretz Yisrael is being consciously run. Now, Kasher Tiru in Tamuz, so this goes in both directions. Just as you'll see, if you do defy my laws, you'll see drought, that negev, and plagues, that chayara, and you'll see waves of wild animals. While everybody else, in very close proximity, will be living tranquilly. The oz teidu, then you'll realize that yes, while the rest of the world are subject to laws of nature, you are directly involved to the master of nature who's running your affairs directly. This is what the Torah is telling us. So that's, now we understand the much deeper significance when the Torah tells us, if you keep the Torah, you'll have your rains at the right time. You'll have plenty. It's not that it begins and ends with rains. And we're hearing that from the perspective of the 9-year-old kid who hears that, yeah, you're able to adjust the temperature with an air conditioning system. But when we're really connecting in this way, we're understanding that there's so much more to that. Hashem is saying, not you will have your rain at the right time. Hashem is saying, I'm going to be on top of your rain. I'm going to be providing your rain. People saw each rain was a sign of divine favor. Each rain was a smile from Hashem. Each yield of crops was a smile from Hashem. That's the significance of this. Therefore, all different significance to all the different material promises that are promised in the Torah. Because Hashem is saying, I want you to experience all this in this world. Your destiny is meant to be lived out here in this world. The Yehudel Kulam Koyaloi Samsheri Shechon. This is not what we said. All these different promises, that broad range of promises, rain and plenty of food and no sickness and victory over the enemies, all that is really just one point. What is Hashem baiting us with, right? What is Hashem tempting us with? The prospect of plenty of rain, plenty of food, etc. That's not the point. The point is Yichu kurvas elekim malachim. What he's trying to bait us with is, you will be close to me. You're going to be my people. I'm going to be your people. I'm going to be running your state of affairs in a direct way. That's what we're longing for in all these things. That's what we're longing for when we hear all these descriptions of, right? The fruit of Eretz Yisrael, how great they were, how today there's no taste to the fruits of Eretz Yisrael, how wheat used to grow to the size of kidneys, and how big all the different fruits were. What's the point of that? The point of that, all that is, Hashem says, forget about noble wheat. Look what I'm going to give you for Shabbos. So the feeling was, when you sit down to that challenge, you mamish feel like you're being served by Hashem. Now, how thrilling it is to eat such a meal? It's not because, the wheat is so much bigger. It's because you are mamish. It's the thrill of feeling that you're being served by Hashem. When people do reach this state, the afterlife is just a natural next step of this whole discussion. They have nothing to fear from death because they're already experiencing that connection to the divine in this world. Why do we not feel anticipation of the afterlife? Why do we feel that with all the promises, I'll take my lousy existence in this world if you'll just let me live forever? It's because, again, for us, this world and the next world are two completely different things. And there's a very, very clear marker between them that's called the grave. Right? Before the grave, there's no next world. After the grave, there's no this world. At that time, there was no clear marker. It was all kind of mushed together. This world, the next world, it was all together. It was all being experienced together. The Beit HaMikdash blended it all together. You saw Shemayim and Aretz all mixing. And therefore a person, if you had a Navi who had already been up for a couple of visits, was he terribly scared of dying? No. He's been there, he knows what it's about. And yes, our Torah showed us all these things in reality. Meaning, in other words, again, let's not view the Judaism that we live with today as the Judaism. That's not what Judaism was meant to be. Soon we'll see what our glorious role is in our pathetic state. We'll see. A lot of significance to that. But actually, what Hashem had in mind for the Jewish people, the destiny of the Jewish people, is the existence in this world that we're describing here. That otherworldly existence in this world. Now that mashal bizeh, he gives a mashal, we'll move quickly through the mashal. Chaverim shayoyimdim b'midbar. They have a group of people, a group of nomads living in the desert. Noach echom nehem el hoidu. One of them went to India. Apparently India was the big kosh of a place in those times, because he keeps drawing on that as the example of a really prosperous king and a kosh of a king. But one of them went to India. Upagami melech hoidu. When he came to India, to his shock, the king of India was interested in having a meeting with him, and the king of India suddenly started showing him all kinds of respect and this and that. Why? Said, oh, you're from that group. You're from that group. Come here, come here, come here. I want to give you the VIP treatment. The guy doesn't understand. Why is the king of India treating me this way? And the king of India says, you have no idea what kind of relationship I had with your father. You might not know me, the king of India says. Oh, but I know you. I'm crazy about your family. No. This is a mashal. And therefore the king of India showered upon him very precious gifts. He comes back to his fellow nomads in the desert, and he's showing this whole array of royal gifts that he got from the king of India, and he's saying, you know what, king of India with his whole great empire was so excited when he found me and when he heard about us. And he also dressed this fellow royal garments. And when he sent them back to his nomad friends in the desert, he sent them back with a whole company, with a whole entourage of royal guard. And none of them had ever dreamed that they would actually gain an audience with this king, and that and that the king would ever send away from his personal guard into this desert. But that's what he's doing, because he's trying to show these people how crazy he is about it. And then the king of India says, you know what, I want to actually maintain an ongoing relationship with you folks there in the desert. So therefore, look, I'm giving you a whole list of instructions, you bring it to them. So then this fellow comes back with that whole entourage of the royal Indian guard. And they can't believe it, right? They said, you know, they're always hearing about the famous Indian guard, and now they're here coming out to them in the midbar. And therefore, they made a point of honoring them. And they built them a palace, and now they have this king's personal attendants going back and forth between the king and them, and they set up a special palace for them to live with. And the king makes a point of sending his closest people to be with them regularly in the desert in order to keep the connection alive. Now, v'sholchu ha'chaverim ha'im sholchim shluchim la'agya al'eretz ha'idim. And now this group of nomads started regularly sending some of their own people back to the king of India, li'ra'is p'nei ha'melech mibli toirach. And they would always be allowed straight into the king without any hindrances. By means of these royal guards who used to escort them back and forth and take them straight into the king's personal chamber, show them where to go. The Yadu Kula, and they all knew that they have this special connection. Anybody who wants to go to the land of India, Kalal of Ma'oid, he has all doors open before him. As long as he makes a point of showing that yes, I'm keeping loyally to this king's instructions and I'm showing proper reverence to his servants and those who represent him. Now these nomads never had to ask. It's never an issue of faith. That's what he's saying. The Jews, their service of Hashem wasn't meant to be a leap of faith. They have always that live connection. They're seeing the live back and forth. Just like these people don't need to ask, what's the basis for my service? Go check it out. You can go to India and see. Meet the king. Right? They see very clearly in front of them that the point is that, yeah, by doing these things, we have all doors open in front of us straight into the king's private chambers. The chevrasi atovat gdeila. And that they all understand, that to be able to be close with the king, have a close personal relationship with him, that's the best thing a person could hope for. So this is basically a mashal for what we've been describing. But the next week we'll see how he'll spell out the nimshal. But basically, really, it's everything we've been describing. He's just summing it up. Okay, that'll be that for this week.